From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, the huge gaps in our knowledge of how the new coronavirus is moving through nursing homes.
The state isn't publishing cumulative cases, so you can't see how these facilities are changing over time. You can't see whether they're improving with their infection control or getting worse.
Also, a stylist in Traverse City talks about who she's missing in the chair and the gray areas for post-pandemic hair salons.
There's more concern about having certain chemicals in the salons than there is on how to keep us safe with the transmission of COVID.
Plus, one high school senior on trying to bring her school community back together online.
I definitely think there are kids who are just, they're ready to graduate, they don't really care anymore. There's 330 kids in our grade, and I think about half of them are actively participating in the events.
Those stories and more coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Yesterday, we talked with a couple of restaurant owners in northern Michigan about reopening to customers. Today, we're going to hear from a stylist in Traverse City, who, along with all stylists and barbers, is still waiting to reopen.
The beauty industry is one of the biggest industries in the world right now. There'll be never a day where we won't make money, but there is a day where your body will just like quit, or during a pandemic, you don't know how you're going to stay safe or keep your clients safe.
More on what's going to happen with salons later in the program. But first, Governor Whitmer gives multiple press conference updates a week on the spread of COVID-19 around the state. Even so, we still don't have very clear information surrounding the spread of the virus in nursing homes and other elder care facilities. A reporter actually asked the governor and the state's chief medical officer, Dr. Jonay Khaldun, about the issue yesterday.
Could you update us on the status of long-term care facility reporting? I know we're transitioning to a new process. Tell us what hasn't been worked and what we can expect.
You see me grabbing my mask because I'm going to hand this over to Dr. J.
Yes, so great question. If you go to our website now, it will say that we are currently updating it, because what has occurred is we are working with our long-term care facilities to make sure we're getting accurate information.
The thing is, this question keeps coming up again and again, and leaders keep saying again and again that they're working on it. Michigan Radio's Will Callen has been looking into COVID-19 in nursing homes, and he joins us now. Hey, Will.
Hey, April.
What data about COVID-19 in nursing homes and other elder care facilities is publicly available right now?
So right now, the only data about long-term care facilities available to the public is for nursing homes. Other long-term care facilities, we don't know anything about at the moment. And for those nursing homes, the state is publishing only active cases in these facilities. So what that means is the number of cases they're counting at a given time. And those numbers are broken down by facility. What active cases means is if a facility has 20 cases one week and then zero the next, and you go to visit the website the next week, you're only going to see that the facility has zero cases. So you can't see how these facilities are changing over time. You can't see whether they're improving with their infection control or getting worse.
I mean, is this the same way other states are tallying the data, just a snapshot on weekly or monthly basis?
So I should be clear in saying the state is definitely collecting more than it's publishing. It's collecting information about deaths and about the availability of personal protective equipment. But no, compared to other states, what it's reporting is pretty scant. Priya Chidambaram is a policy analyst with the Kaiser Family Foundation, and she has been studying what states report about long-term care facilities.
Michigan is an interesting state because they report slightly different data than a lot of states. For one, they are only reporting cases. They have not reported any official state death data. They also only report active cases.
Well, that seems like an important distinction, active cases versus the people who've actually died from COVID-19. What do we know about death rates?
So, again, this isn't being posted online, but the last I heard in speaking with MDHHS is that they represent about 15% of the state's total number of deaths at nursing homes do. But They are not confident in that number. They think that it's an undercount.
And we've seen some reporting that it could be. Deaths in nursing homes account for as much as 30 to 40% of all COVID-related deaths nationally. Well, why is it that the state is not confident in these numbers? Are they explaining why this information hasn't been readily available?
So for deaths, we're told that that has to do with the reliability of the data. Some facilities have been reporting cumulative deaths. Others have just been reporting the daily count. And in a lot of those cases, the health department doesn't know which is which. The reason we're getting inconsistent reporting from facilities is because reporting instructions and definitions on these data categories, they haven't been totally clear. You know, I should also note that this isn't information a nursing home would want publicized. You know, it could threaten a facility's ability to attract more paying residents. But these reporting requirements are just that. They're requirements and not suggestions.
So as of a few days ago, not even the numbers that the state was willing to publish were available. The website where this info is posted has been undergoing some kind of change. Do you know when it's going to be back up?
So I don't know exactly when it's going to be a backup. MDHHS, they are changing the reporting requirements. And the reason they're doing so is to fix this confusion around what data needs to be reported and what the definitions for the data categories are. Once the changes are made, Michigan's reporting requirements will more or less line up with new requirements for nursing homes that are coming from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. You know, some examples of that are confirmed cases, suspected cases, deaths, staff shortages, and PPE availability. Again, we don't know how much of this new data Michigan is going to show on its site, but CMS said that it plans to publish facility-specific data on its site coming up.
Will, you've spoken with families who have older relatives in nursing homes. I mean, how are they even getting their information at this point?
Yeah, so some of the people who would find this information the most useful are just those folks, people with loved ones in nursing facilities or people considering placing a loved one in a facility. They do have some resources available to them. There's a website that CMS runs called Nursing Home Compare, where they can find out about a facility's track record. But we know that there have been COVID outbreaks in both poorly and highly rated nursing homes. So to figure out what's going on with COVID at facilities, a lot of families have been relying on staff members to tell them what's happening on the inside.
Which they're probably not supposed to be doing anyway.
Right. Yeah. It's creating a difficult situation for everybody. The families can't be totally confident in the information they're getting, and the staff members are risking their jobs to, you know, get these family members information that they really dearly need. But the problem with that is, you know, you can't be totally confident in even that information. Say there's a facility that doesn't seem like there has been COVID. None of the patients are symptomatic. If there isn't testing happening in the facility, you cannot know that that's true. We know that a lot of nursing home residents who've tested positive for COVID-19 have been asymptomatic. In April, Detroit tested all the residents and staff in their nursing homes. And for the residents, they found that the number of asymptomatic patients was almost as high as the number of symptomatic patients. Kathy Sunland, she's the vice president of regulatory services at the Healthcare Association of Michigan, which is an industry group that represents nursing homes. And she says that MDHHS knows there needs to be testing at all of these facilities.
There's a recognition that testing is required. It's a necessary component in the fight against COVID, because that's really the way that we can identify where the virus is at and isolate it to stop transmission.
Sunland, she's part of a working group at MDHHS, and they're trying to come up with a universal testing strategy for nursing homes, and there are other teams working on a strategy for other long-term care facilities. Again, universal and regular testing is a foundational piece of making this data accurate, because without it, a lot of the task of counting COVID cases is just guesswork.
Michigan Radio's Will Callen. You can read his story about information on COVID infection rate at nursing homes at michiganradio.org. Will, thanks.
Thanks, April.
The reality of the lack of information about what's going on in Michigan's nursing homes and assisted livings can be extremely emotional and very personal for folks who are separated from their family members. There's a guy who works in the building where Michigan Radio is located who's found some unusual ways to stay in touch with his dad. Chris McElroy joins us now. Chris, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Do you want to tell us about where your dad's living?
Yeah, he's in a retirement community in Ann Arbor. It's called Brookhaven. We are trying to just stay in touch with him as much as we can. And so we're having these virtual happy hours, you know, using Zoom or whatever every Friday evening. And he was running out of whiskey to make his Manhattan. And so I took him a bottle of whiskey and went to the building, and he was on his balcony. I tossed him up a rope. He dropped it down to me, and we attached a little backpack, put the whiskey in there. He hoisted it up, and we went on to have our happy hour on Friday.
Whiskey ex machina.
Yes.
That's genius. Chris, how would you say your physical sense of your dad and just your emotional relationship has changed through all this?
You know, what is hard is he's 93. He'll be 94 before long. And it's very difficult for him. You know, we lost our mom a couple years ago, and they were together forever. And it's for him to just be completely alone and not have direct contact with us. We have a lot of siblings, and he's used to getting a lot of visitors coming into his apartment. And so the separation is very hard for him, for us as well. And, you know, he's not getting any younger, and he feels like he's losing some of his strength, and it's hard to hear him talking and saying, you know, he's losing more of his strength, more of his, you know, ability to get around and stuff, and to not be able to be there with him and help him with whatever.
Chris, we know this isn't an easy situation, and we really do wish you and your dad the best and hope that you can see him sooner rather than later, up close.
Yeah, thanks very much. We can't wait for that day.
Coming up, a high school senior and her classmates plan virtual celebrations since in-person graduation's off the table.
We're having a drive-thru at our school where all the teachers are going to be standing outside social distancing, and the seniors in there are going to wear their cap and gowns and drive through the parking lot with their families.
That's after a break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. You know, we keep referring to Michigan high schoolers as stuck at home during the COVID quarantine, bored, staring at their phones. Well, let's remember, they're not all spending the time that way. Olivia Yates is a high school senior at Groves High School in Beverly Hills. Olivia is a member of her school's student governance and has played a part in planning virtual events for her class, helping to raise $80,000 for events and charitable projects. Olivia Yates, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So you have a role in Student Congress. Can you explain what your role is and how your class has been talking about a sense of community or school spirit as the year comes to an end?
Yeah, so in Student Congress, I'm one of the directors of community service. So basically what we do is we plan blood drives, we plan community service events, we keep track of everyone's community service hours, and the senior class, basically, we all plan events together, and we have two class presidents who, they kind of are like our leaders, and they instruct us, and basically over the quarantine, we've been having Zoom meetings where we get together and we say, how can we make, we've had so many canceled events, how can we make these better? And so we've been planning a lot of events. A couple of them have been actually happening. Unfortunately, a lot of them don't get to happen just due to quarantines and stay-at-home orders. But we've been trying really hard to get most of our events to happen.
I know one of the events that you've worked on in the past is blood drives and plasma drives. And obviously, those are two things that are in very high demand right now. Have you been able to continue working on them?
Yeah. So actually, me and one of the other directors of community service, her name is Katie Leckin, we have been working with Versity in Michigan and our advisor, Amanda, and we've been trying to plan a blood drive because we were supposed to have two blood drives at the end of the year, a community-wide one and a school-wide one, which we would have raised like 140 donors, which is really needed right now. So unfortunately, it got canceled. So we're working right now to have one in the summer. They have a Summer of Love blood drive program, and we're hoping to have one either once the stay-at-home order is lifted, at our school, or maybe at a local fire station or police station. We just have to wait for the stay-at-home order to be lifted, but we're currently working on making advertisements and publicity for it. So I'm really excited to have that happen.
What kind of conversations have you been having about what would be different about high school organized blood drive now?
Yeah, so obviously, like, safety and health is the number one concern. So we wouldn't want anyone to come in who's been feeling sick, who's been not quarantining themselves, and we've been talking, and we just want to make sure if we do it, it's safe, and no one's going to get sick when they come in to do it, but also, at the same time, they need blood, so we're hoping, so we've been talking about just how can we make it as safe as possible, as clean as possible, and just making sure when you go in, you don't feel uncomfortable, you don't feel like you're going to potentially get sick when you're there. You know, everyone, like anyone who's volunteering, will be forced to wear a mask and probably gloves, and we'll follow all of the state's guidelines for social distancing. But yeah, we just want to make sure it's a safe environment so you can give back to your community without like potentially getting sick or ruining your health.
Are there other virtual events that either you've taken part in or you've helped to plan?
Yeah, so we've had a few. So one of our biggest things is we made an Instagram account for the 2020 seniors, and we've been posting everyone's accomplishments and what their futures entail. And it's not an event, but I think people look forward to seeing the posts every day because it's your classmates. You know, we never really got to have that one last goodbye where you could see where everyone's going and what they're doing with their futures. So I think everyone loves that. We had a virtual Spirit Week because unfortunately our Charity Week, which is usually a really big thing at our school every year, got canceled. So we had a virtual Spirit Week where people would post pictures of them in their different like outfits and their activities at their homes. So like an example was we had like a pajama day where everyone posted a picture in their pajamas, and then you posted a picture of the baking item you made that day.
What's the difference between pajama day and any other day right now?
Exactly. For me, I was like, that's just my normal outfit. But right. Some people posted like funny, like in their Christmas pajamas. I have like a pancake two-piece set that I really like to wear for pajamas. So I think people really enjoyed that, and it kind of brought us together as a class because we never got like our one day together where everyone got to say goodbye. And our last Charity Week, which we would have raised over like $70,000, which people like, we really go full out for that. So I think people really liked being able to do something as a school-wide event, but still from the safety of your homes. And then we also have we're having a virtual honors convocation and graduation, but hopefully we're able to have one in the summer. But actually this week, we're having it on the 31st, so technically I'm graduating on the 31st, so that's exciting. And then we're doing we had like a senior video where two girls made just a kind of like a remembrance of the year, and everyone loved that. It was like a virtual viewing party, so it premiered on YouTube and everyone was watching it, and you could see like there was a chat bar and everyone was talking, and I think people also really liked that because it was like all these memories from throughout the year of field day, Spirit Week, sporting events, which also got everyone together again. Oh, and then in a few days, we're having like a drive-by. So it's not a virtual event, but we're having a drive-through at our school where all the teachers are going to be standing outside social distancing, and the seniors are going to wear their cap and gowns and drive through the parking lot with their families. And I think it's another way to just kind of say goodbye to our teachers and have that like one last goodbye that we never had to get.
Olivia, you sound like the kind of person who was not going to spend her physical distancing time just hanging around watching Netflix all day.
Yeah, I'm definitely not that type of person.
But do you think that there are things about this that have maybe made you have kicked your organizing gene into overdrive that maybe you're doing even more than you would be doing normally?
I think some days there are days when I have like Zooms back to back, you know, I'm constantly texting people and I get a little overwhelmed because you plan all these things, but then you don't actually get to see them happen right away. And I think during the time of the year that we were at, I probably would have actually been planning these many things and being this involved. I've always been super involved in school and had a lot of school spirit, so I love to do things, to do events at our school. But I think it's definitely a challenge for me planning all these events, and then you send it to your administrators and they just shoot it right down. And I hope, or it's definitely been a challenge seeing, trying to plan these things and being super overwhelmed and seeing nothing happen because of it.
Do the events that you are able to see through and you are able to take part in, how do they feel different to you?
I think when you're standing there in one of your events and you just kind of think to yourself, like, oh, if everything was going normal right now, I'd be with my friends and I'd be with my teachers who I love. And I think there's like a sadness that overwhelms you, and but then you have to remember that like, it's bigger than you right now. It's bigger than anyone right now. Everything is, you know, we're doing this to protect our grandparents and our family. And I think it's a mix of being overwhelmingly sad and overwhelmingly just proud of yourself that you can stay home and we have the ability to stay home. I think it's a mix of just sadness, but also you're just really happy that you can help protect your community.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like maybe some kids might be a little checked out of events because they kind of are having a big mix of feelings about what's going on right now?
Yeah, I definitely think there are kids who are just, they're ready to graduate. They don't really care anymore. There's 330 kids in our grade, and I think about half of them are actively participating in the events. And the other half are kind of just like, give me my diploma. I'll see you guys at the five-year reunion. And it's upsetting because, you know, you're never going to see these kids again unless you're going to college with them or you stay in contact with them. So it's frustrating for someone like me who has a lot of school spirit and likes to be involved when you see someone who doesn't really want to be involved, but you're trying your hardest to make sure everyone feels included. But it's hard to include someone if they have to go on their phone and join it, you know?
Yeah. You're attending University of Michigan this fall, right?
Yeah, I am.
What's your plan to study?
I'm hopefully going to study political science and then go to law school.
Are there considerations that have come up for you for how this is going to work? Do you even know if you'll be able to live in a dorm this fall?
Yeah, so University of Michigan president has been pretty open about saying that hopefully we're going to go back, but with under social distancing rules. So there's rumors that there's going to be one to a dorm. There's going to be half capacity. Like if you live in Michigan, you might have to live from home. There's a lot of rumors going around. So I'm definitely worried that I'm not going to get the like freshman year experience. You know, people always say that they hate the dorms, but I think it's like a coming of age. You have to live in your dorm. You have to like experience like the communal bathrooms. So I'm worried that, you know, we're not going to get that. And obviously it's not the biggest deal if we don't get it, but it still feels like it's like a rite of passage.
Do you have any fears for yourself, or do you ever get nervous thinking about living communally?
Sometimes, because I know personally I've been staying safe and keeping my distance, but you don't know, there's people coming from all over the country, all over the world who goes to Michigan, and, you know, communal bathrooms, it's kind of like, it's a great place to get sick from someone else, and, you know, people always say freshman year, in the winter, everyone gets really sick, so hopefully it's the flu and not COVID-19, but that's definitely a worry of mine because I like to keep myself healthy and clean. You don't know where other people are doing.
Do you know anyone who's been sick?
I do. A couple of my friends have had it. Some of my friends' grandparents have had it, luckily, and they were fine. I haven't been personally, like, no one of my family's had it, but definitely people in my area I've had it, and it's really scary. They told me about their symptoms, and it just sounds like such a horrible, horrible disease to have. I just want to also put out there, you know, it's been a really difficult time, and my issues and the high school graduate and celebrations are definitely not at the forefront of what's going on right now. Everyone's health and safety is the most important thing. and like social distancing, wearing a mask, and just being safe are 100% the top priority right now. But also, being a high school graduate, it's nice to see like the LeBron James graduation thing or special. That was really nice to see Barack Obama's speech. I love that. It definitely made me feel appreciated. But also, it just was really important that everyone knows that, well, it's okay to feel bad for us, but like we're not the most important issue right now.
Sure. You know, a lot of people spend the summer after high school just working. Mm-hmm. What's your plan for that?
Yeah, so hopefully there will be jobs available. I'm most likely going to babysit just because I have a family that I can babysit for, and it's just a good way to make money before you're going into school. But I definitely think that's going to be a problem for a lot of high schoolers who have jobs that are going to need to be covered by working class people who actually need the money to support their families, compared to high schoolers or graduated high schoolers who need the money to help with college. So I think, luckily, I think I'll be okay, but I think it's definitely going to be a problem for majority of high school graduates.
Olivia, thank you so much for your time, and good luck this summer and fall.
Thank you so much for having me.
Olivia Yates is graduating from Groves High School in Beverly Hills. In his latest novel, entitled The Narcissism of Small Differences, Michael Zadorian takes us into the fictional lives of two self-absorbed, lifelong Metro Detroiters in their 40s. Stateside's book critic Keith Taylor has this review.
Sigmund Freud invented lots of words and phrases that have entered our speech. Some we use almost every day, although we've long forgotten where they came from. One phrase I've always thought deserved more play is the narcissism of small differences. Freud used it to help us understand why countries that are close together and share many cultural traditions are the most likely to go to war. These countries become obsessed with and protective of the tiny things that separate them. The extension to human relationships is obvious, even necessary. And that is exactly what Detroit's Michael Zadorian has done in his new novel. The novel takes place in 2009, when the city was at what might have been its lowest point, where the first glimmers of change were seldom seen. But Detroiters still celebrated their city, its grittiness, its survival instincts. The characters in The Narcissism of Small Differences are about to turn 40, too young to be boomers, yet far too old to have the technological enthusiasms and abilities of millennials. They might be part of what we've called the me generation. That phrase certainly describes the central characters of Zadorian's novel. Joe and Anna begin as a sympathetic, even if self-absorbed, couple, lifelong Detroiters both, who have been together for some 15 years by the time the novel begins. They've never married because they've never felt the need. They certainly don't feel the need for children. They have a nice, affordable, small house in Ferndale, just north of 8 Mile, but far enough away to make them worried about becoming suburbanites. Anna makes the most money working for an advertising company. Joe writes music reviews for alternative publications in the city. I don't think I'd be alone in seeing the Metro Times in here. But as they prepare for 40, their attitudes start changing. They both take better-paying jobs that they hate. They start looking at other people with a bit more interest. And they start finding fault with each other, start accentuating those small differences. And I have to make sure I mention that along the way, they're often quite funny. It's both interesting and laughable to see how or if they work things out. Zadorian has spent his whole life in Detroit, and the city has been central to everything he has written. Even in small moments, the attitudes of the city shape the characters and their speech. For instance, only a Detroiter or someone who loves the city can truly get the mix of bitterness and humor that makes one character respond when asked why a building is being torn down. Why else do they tear anything down in Detroit? For a parking lot. Michael Zadorian writes good novels, and The Narcissism of Small Differences is one of his best. He has become an essential chronicler of the life in Detroit at the beginning of our century.
Stateside's book critic Keith Taylor. We actually talked to author Michael Zadorian about his new book. You can catch the Stateside interview at our website. It's michiganradio.org. In the era of COVID-19, we're all under a lot of pressure. Mental, physical, emotional, and spiritual. And fairly normal tasks, like that quick trip to the store, are not so quick any longer. Included in this new normal is wearing masks in public. Even that simple preventative health measure is now contentious. We were curious about your experience publicly wearing masks. Have you been the object of public ridicule for not wearing a mask correctly, for not wearing one at all, or maybe even for wearing one? Stateside wants to hear your stories. Drop us an email at stateside@michiganradio.org. You can also tweet to us at Stateside Radio or leave us a voicemail. The number is 734-764-7840. After the break, one hairstylist from Traverse City talks about going from full-time work to full-time quarantine.
Working 10 hours a day to talking to people all day long, and then I was just inside. Nothing.
That's next on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. As Governor Whitmer has begun cautiously rolling back restrictions on businesses, there is one sector that has rather famously remained closed. And I say famously because of the many unfortunate images on social media of citizens cutting, coloring, and styling their own hair, in addition to a few widely publicized hair care professionals who've taken part in anti-quarantine demonstrations. There are so many barbers, stylists, nail technicians, and others in the industry left hanging in Michigan right now. These people are often our friends. They're people who know so many of the details of our lives, our kids' names, what's going on with our relationships, all because of our time in the chair. Laura Rose is a stylist who you could find before the pandemic at Salon Saloon in Traverse City. And she joins us now for a check-in. Laura Rose, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me. Hello.
Is it weird seeing some of the restaurants and bars and shops reopening for business while you're still kind of stuck in stasis?
Yeah, you know, it is. And up here in Traverse City, though, you know, it seemed like a 50-50. There was some restaurants that were deciding to open and some are kind of like, no, we'll wait and see what happens before they did. And I guess I was kind of looking forward to maybe a slow tourist season, which is horrible, but at the same time, to enjoy our town because we worked so hard to really crush the curve. We didn't flatten it. We crushed it here in Traverse City. So everyone was a little on edge, for sure.
Right. Laura, when's the last time you saw a customer?
I haven't done a client since I think it was the first week of March.
Wow. How are you doing going so long without working?
You know, there has been so much that's going on and it comes in waves. I was fortunate enough to be able to take advantage of the PUA and the unemployment. And that has worked out as well as getting insurance too. So I've been good, but there's just so many people that aren't. But I honestly miss my coworkers. I miss my clients. You know, Salon Saloon's in front of Right Brain Brewery. And my boyfriend happens to work there as well. And I just miss them. We're like a big family. So it's working 10 hours a day to talking to people all day long. And then I was just inside. Nothing.
Yeah. What's the talk amongst you and your colleagues and your coworkers and just people you know in the industry? You've been working in this industry for about 15 years. What is the talk about how many places will never reopen?
You know, that is a reality. I have been on the phone with other hairdressers that are friends of mine downstate. I've been on social media with my hairdresser friends across the country. And with my coworkers, we literally text each other every day. We have this group chat that goes off all the time. We haven't really talked about if we can't go back to work because our boss has worked so hard to keep us in a great position. But honestly, I can see where there's a lot of people that might have a salon suite, hairdressers that might not be able to reopen because they have to get PPE and they've gone without income for 3 months already. And like friends of mine, and they've had that instance where actually they've made too much money, but since they own the salon, they don't get any PUA or assistance.
When you say too much money, you mean too much to qualify for benefits?
Right. Too much to qualify for benefits, but not enough to get the loan that they were giving out for small businesses.
Yeah.
We've seen that and it's scary. I mean, for me, even as an independent contractor, I do have to think about my boss is amazing and she would do anything to make sure that my clients and me are safe. But technically I'm 1099, so I have to supply my own supplies. Where do I get that?
Right.
We've been talking about it and it's scary.
There are some professions that go through cycles. I think about what happened in the trades during the Great Recession. You know, there were some people who might have, you know, been doing plumbing or contracting who just decided, you know what, I need to think about something else that is going to sustain my family. Have you or people you know been thinking about a change of career?
Yeah, there has been that talk. I've actually been full-time going back for my bachelor's degree. So I kind of have graphic design or marketing to fall back on.
And that predates what's happening with the pandemic.
Yeah, and that's just because I've been doing this for 15 years. The beauty industry is one of the biggest industries in the world right now. There'll be never a day where we won't make money. But there is a day where your body will just like quit. Or during a pandemic, you don't know how you're going to stay safe or keep your clients safe. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I've had a couple with my old coworkers and my girlfriend, Jessie, who's a hairdresser too. We actually had this talk where in the beginning of this, you know, when everyone was freaking out, I feel like no matter if you're staying home or you're social distancing or not, or whatever's going on, there is a little bit of a lease of a panic now. Before when they were, you know, we didn't know when we were supposed to shut down, if we were supposed to be going to work, and all this was intensifying. You know, I have a girlfriend that moved back downstate to go back to barber school because that's like how you get your master's basically in hairdressing. Mm-hmm. So she have both of her licenses from the state of Michigan. And because of COVID, she had to obviously drop out. She came back up here, but then it's like, is this one-on-one job like this, is this sustainable for going through what we're going through?
I mean, I know you're not an epidemiologist, but do you think it's possible to cut hair safely?
I am not an epidemiologist, no. I do know because we are licensed by the state and we are licensed by LARA, we have such strict protocols already to keep our clients safe. And if you Google anything from CDC or LARA, or even OSHA, it's all talking about blood-borne pathogens, right? So AIDS, hepatitis. There's nothing on how to keep the flu or keep people from passing on something left and right. And there's more concern about having certain chemicals in the salons than there is on how to keep us safe with the transmission of COVID. You know, I have had my own health issues this year. And I have been susceptible. I already had pneumonia last summer, and I already had a respiratory infection in February. So I'm just prone to picking things up. And I have surgery in 2 weeks, so my immune system is just kind of down. So do I want to go back after that? Oh, it's totally uncertain. And it is, as much as we love what we do, and for me, as much as I love what I do, and I love my clients, and it hurts to not do what I do for a living, I am definitely second guessing myself, like, is this the place to be? Like, am I going to be able to do this for the rest of my life?
Laura, I don't want to put you on the spot for what other people might be doing with their clients, but, you know, some stylists are seeing people on the down low. How widespread do you think that is?
You know, in the beginning of everything. I was on the fence about even just taking clients too. I'm not going to lie. You know, hairdressers hustle.
Yeah.
Fortunately, my clientele are made up of men and women that I've been doing for almost 2 to 3 years. So I know everything about them, like you had said earlier. I know if they've been quarantining or not, because we're either on Facebook or texting each other and saying, stay safe. You know, do you know when we're open? Help me, my groups. But at the same time, I did, but then I didn't. And I was getting a little pressure. I'm not going to lie. I did get a couple, even from my family, of just, oh, come on, we can cut hair. Mm-hmm. And I ended up doing my boyfriend's family members right when this first started, before the shutdown happened. And I was like, this will probably be your last haircut. So I know that they're doing that. And, you know, it's the same thing with the social distancing. I think it goes as a whole, is that there are people who believe in it and there are people who are not. So like anything else, you're going to do that. I just hope that salons that are doing that, or styles that are doing that, are being safe, because eventually we are going to go back to work, and we don't want something like that had happened in Missouri, mm-hmm. where the two women went to work and then 140 people now have been affected.
Yeah.
I can just see that happening here.
Are there ways that you could see the beauty industry changing, you know, assuming that there's not a vaccine in the immediate future?
Really, I see what is going to be definitely changing, and which is the sad part, because most salons work really, that's their number one priority, is just the client experience. We like to roll out the red carpet for our clients, because this is their time. This is their time to degress, to kind of de-stress and feel beautiful. It's going to definitely be weird, but I can definitely see hopefully bigger salons, like chain salons, just revamping, redoing, and remodeling to keep things safe. So that could be the exciting part.
Laura, thank you for talking to us about all this. And
I mean,
we wish we really do wish you all the best, whichever way things go for you, either with your degree or if you're still cutting hair maybe a year from now.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Laura Rose of Salon Saloon in Traverse City. You remember what Laura Rose was saying a few minutes ago about that first day of business up north? We actually spoke with a couple of restaurateurs about their decisions to open or to stay closed a little bit longer. In case you missed those conversations yesterday, check them out on our podcast feed. It's available on NPR One, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you download. When you do hear them, you may get some clues about what dining out is going to look like for all of us all around Michigan in the months to come. Mark Kurliancik writes about restaurants and the restaurant business for the Detroit Free Press, and he spent the weekend up north with an eye to this very thing. He joins us now to tell us about it. Hi, Mark.
Hello, how are you?
I'm all right. Where did you spend your weekend?
I was in Traverse City, and actually I've been there for the last, I've spent about 5 nights there, just kind of covering the partial reopenings of bars and restaurants.
Can we talk first about customer base? I was curious whether you observed a lot of people just showing up to restaurants and bars.
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely some out-of-town tourists in town. I mean, and this is something that I could just, as through my reporting, I talked to folks who were eating in restaurants and drinking in bars, and pretty much everyone that I spoke with was from out of town. So yeah, there are people eating in bars. They're not, I wouldn't say, you know, there were no lines out the door. They weren't slammed, obviously, because of the maximum capacity rules. But yeah, there were certainly people who were in town and some who came specifically just to drink and eat and shop at the newly reopened bars and restaurants and retail shops.
Did you see people wearing masks and observing physical distancing?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, my first night I was in Kalkaska at a bar that opened right at midnight. And in Kalkaska, there were no masks. I was the only one that had a mask with me. But in Traverse City, a lot of the business owners that did decide to open have been very strict. And you know, there's signs that tell you to put your mask on inside. When you go to a restaurant, you have to be wearing your mask to get in. Typically, they have people basically greeting you at the front door before you walk in, so they can tell you whether there is room for you or not. Then they instruct you to put your mask on. Some require you to sanitize your hands as you're walking in. And then once you get to your table is when, you know, you're free to take your mask off and, you know, enjoy your food as it comes. But if you want to go up to, and get to go to the bathroom or, you know, walk around the space for whatever reason, you know, they are requiring for you to wear masks. And pretty much everyone that I saw that was, you know, inside was wearing masks. Outside, it was definitely a little more hit or miss.
So what other kinds of precautions were some restaurants and bars taking beyond what they were asking their patrons to do? Was there anything special you saw on servers or chefs?
Yeah, I mean, there were, you know, there's plexiglass installed at a lot of host stands now, or places where there are, you know, kind of one-on-one exchanges of money. We had dinner in Sutton's Bay at the Village Inn, and there they actually did a touchless form of payment where they drop off your check, but your check has a QR code on it that you just snap a photo with your camera, and it automatically takes you to your receipt, and you just actually pay the entire bill online. You know, they never touch a credit card or anything. You just handle the entire transaction through your phone.
Oh, wow.
That was some pretty interesting technology. Also, reformatting the dining room so that they hold less people. You know, those are kind of the biggest changes. Some places are also going to, you know, single-use paper menus, lots of signage with, you know, new house rules, obviously. But everyone's kind of taking it a little bit differently. Some are still using regular plates and dishes. And then I, you know, there's a couple of restaurants that I went to that everything was being served in takeout containers with plasticware that you just threw out at the end of your meal. And they asked you to take care of that yourself.
Of all the things you saw, what do you think this tells us about what maybe folks in some of the different metro areas might expect of dining out once that's a possibility again?
Well, I mean, I think that the biggest thing is that we're not going to be returning to, you know, packed houses and, you know, communal dining is pretty much gone. You know, the communal seating at dining rooms, I think, if not gone forever, is gone for a good long while. You know, we're talking about dining rooms that don't quite have the energy that they used to. And, you know, there weren't a ton of places that were open. Up in Traverse City, a lot of the businesses had decided to kind of wait until after this weekend, until after the tourists went home, to fully reopen for their locals, because people are still, you know, business owners too are still very wary of this thing. You know, it could spread. So this is a long road, and this is kind of just the first step. But you know, I guess the next 2 weeks will kind of bear out and tell us whether this is an actual, you know, glimpse of the future, or if this was too soon. We'll find out, I guess.
So as you think this through, Mark, is there a type of restaurant that you're worried about right now?
I mean, fine dining is certainly going to struggle the most. You know, it's not a white tablecloth place, but a place where, you know, two people would drop over $100 to eat dinner with a bottle of wine. And those types of places, they usually staff very heavy. And labor costs are one of the big things that drive restaurant budgets up and make those margins so small. So, you know, they staff heavy and they rely on butts and seats. And you know, when you can only serve half or less of the amount of folks that you used to before, it's a new game. I'm not quite sure anyone's really figured it out yet. And I have a feeling that a lot of the fine dining places that will choose to keep this kind of a service-driven format will have to institute either even higher prices or some kind of additional service fee, just because I don't see the margins working at half capacity.
You know, the kind of places that you're talking about, a kind of, you know, curated meal where you might drop $100 for dinner for two, what does that represent in terms of the broader ecosystem of the restaurant business? I mean, isn't that a place where chefs might experiment and, you know, kind of do their own thing and try stuff out?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, I would say that there's a sort of culinary renaissance that's happened in the last, you know, 10, 15 years. And in Michigan, it's certainly in the last 10. It's a lot of these independently owned chefs that are kind of at this upper tier that have been pushing the dialogue forward and getting, you know, all kinds of national media attention, even international media attention, and drawing attention to places like Detroit or Traverse City, you know, places that are experiencing sort of tourism, or Detroit, where the tourism was starting to increase the last few years. They've kind of been central to pushing this dialogue of, you know, come enjoy our food, enjoy our drinks. And now these are really the places that are going to be threatened. And instead, I think we'll focus more on kind of serving the local community, which is, you know, I don't think that's a bad thing by any means either. It's just going to be different.
We spoke with a restaurateur who said that she felt the 50% capacity rule was perhaps arbitrary or unrealistic, that, you know, she just felt like she didn't have enough good information about what was really safe for reopening. You talk to a lot of restaurant owners. Would you say that there are others who share that view?
I would say that there is an overall frustration on the way that this has been rolled out. I mean, 4 days to prepare for reopening a restaurant that's been closed in 2 weeks. Just, you know, a lot of the folks that I talked to spoke about a frustration or a lack of understanding on the governor's part or on the state's part of what it takes to actually run and open a place like this. And that the guidelines just haven't been very clear. So they haven't been given much time and they're getting all kinds of mixed signals. So folks are kind of just reaching in the dark and just trying to see what works. And a lot of this is really just going to come down to your personal feelings of safety, your own personal, you know, responsibility and what makes you feel safe. And I think that applies for restaurants as well.
Mark Kurliancik writes about restaurants and the restaurant business for the Detroit Free Press. He wrote a really interesting article about spending the weekend up north and what he saw in restaurants and bars around the area. Mark, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Take care of yourself. We'll see you tomorrow.